Welcome to CPS Podcast, a podcast that retells true crime stories of children that were harmed by their caregivers and involved with Child Protective Services. Each week, we cover a story in two parts. The first tells the story, and the second will give us a chance to discuss it. We'd love for you to participate in the discussion, and you can do so by visiting our website at cpspodcast.com. We are excited to incorporate your thoughts and comments and be able to address them. Our website also has a full list of our sources, photos of the people and places that appear in each story, and it gives a heads up of upcoming podcasts. For our very first podcast, we have to go all the way back to the 1870s in New York City to retell the story of Little Mary Ellen. To do this, we piece together information from the New York Times archive. We did this because this is one way to get information from an account that actually happened almost 150 years ago. This story has some controversy, and we really wanted to do it justice. It was crazy, really, because the more I looked into this story, the more I kept finding conflicting accounts about Mary Ellen's story. Having said all this, I start right away with conflict involving the age of Little Mary Ellen. As most articles today, and if you do a quick Google search, you'll find many, have her age at 10 years old. But the New York Times articles, back from the 1870s, say she's 8 years old. And I assure you, the age of Mary Ellen isn't the only controversy. I'll call these differing accounts out along the way. So what we do know, or at least I'm pretty sure of, is that Little Mary Ellen was born to Thomas and Frances Wilson. They met while both working at the St. Nicholas, a luxury hotel located on Broadway in New York City. Thomas was an oyster shucker, and Frances was a laundress. So Frances was doing the laundry for the rich people, and Thomas was making sure their juicy oysters were ready to be eaten. Now, some modern-day accounts of the Wilson family have it so that Mom didn't begin working until after Dad left to fight for the Union in the Civil War. But the New York Times article published in May of 1874 actually states that they did meet while both working at the St. Nicholas Hotel. Both Frances and Thomas were first-generation immigrants, and in their early 20s when they met. Thomas had come to America from Ireland, escaping the devastating potato famine, and Frances came from England in search of a better life in America. Unfortunately, I don't think the American dream panned out for either Thomas or Frances. Unlike the regal St. Nicholas Hotel where the couple worked, they lived in ramshackle tenement housing within the Hell's Kitchen area of New York City. Nowhere in the United States today can match the horrendous and large impact of the conditions of the tenement housing where Thomas and Frances lived in the 1860s. There was no indoor plumbing, but instead rows of outhouses lined the outside of the tenements. Imagine if you ate something that didn't sit well with you and you had the craps. That'd be such a long, horrific night. The tenement houses were made up of single rooms and were damp and cramped without ventilation. The streets ran with sewage, and disease was much more of a problem than it is today. But you can imagine why that is when we begin by explaining outhouses lined the city streets behind the tenement buildings. Rents were without regulation, and rent control was unheard of. Thomas and Frances knew that they could be forced to leave with only a few days' notice, so security was not a thing. But love is love, and Thomas and Frances apparently did love one another. It wasn't long after they married that Frances was excited to learn she was pregnant with little Mary Ellen. Despite the cramped and difficult housing situation, low wages, and rampant disease, Thomas and Frances were full of hope and excited to become a family of three. What I Know I Wish Stayed a Love Story took a sad turn towards tragedy when Thomas felt a duty to leave his family and joined the Union to do his part to fight in the Civil War. For a country he credited with saving him from starvation, he felt becoming a soldier and fighting for the Union was the least that he could do. In our ideal version of this story, the couple write to one another as the war stretches on and their child, little Mary Ellen, is born a healthy little girl while the couple are separated but then happily reunited. But when Mary Ellen is only a young baby, sadly her father, Thomas, dies in battle. Or so we think, and I will come back to this later. We do know that Frances is now alone and receives no money from Thomas. There are some reports of a widower's pension being received by Frances due to Thomas's death, but even that has some controversy. This is where it starts to get gritty. As Frances decides to have little Mary Ellen boarded with a woman named Mary Score. At least the New York Times refers to this boarder as Mary Score. Many more modern-day accounts refer to Mary Ellen's boarder as Martha Score. It's just another small tidbit to keep in mind. It's also important to know that someone who boarded children, like Mary Score didn't just take the kids for 8 hours a day so Frances could work. Miss Score had Mary Ellen around the clock, and Frances reportedly never saw little Mary Ellen after Miss Score began boarding her. Now the story goes from gritty to salacious, and also more factual, as it is pretty well documented in a series of articles written by the New York Times from April of 1874 through till December of 1874. Strangely, most accounts of Mary Ellen's story that we read from more modern sources leave much of the information from these many articles out of their account. But we're going to let these articles guide us almost completely going forward. We know that the Department of Charities in New York City have on file that little Mary Ellen was dropped off with no parents listed. Although we don't know exactly how old she was at this time or when exactly she arrived, Mary Score, the boarder that Frances Wilson gave Mary Ellen to, later testifies in court that a chambermaid named Mrs. Cavanaugh gave Mary Ellen to Miss Score and that a Fanny Wilson is the mother to the child, but that Miss Score only met Fanny Wilson once, and that was to get the ticket for the widower's pension. When Miss Score then tried to collect the $2 a week widower's pension, it is denied, and it's at this point that Miss Score makes the decision to drop off little Mary Ellen with the Department of Charities. We also know that in February of 1866, a man named Mr. Kellogg, who was the superintendent at the Department of Charities back in the day, allowed a butcher named Thomas McCormick and his wife, Mary McCormick, to enter into an indenture agreement to care for Mary Ellen. And this pretty much signed up Mary Ellen to work for the privilege to live with the McCormicks. A record of this account was presented in court in 1874, with Mary Ellen being documented as age 18 months at the time when this agreement was signed. There is some conflict with whether Mary Ellen's second set of I don't want to call them parents, so I'll just say adults, were what we'd consider adoptive parents or foster parents. I think it's clear that there was no real formal process for either, and the indenture agreement is a more accurate reflection of what Mary McCormick had in mind when she went with her husband, Thomas, to get Mary Ellen from the Department of Charities. To give you some reference, when you're thinking about foster or adoptive parents during this time period, it's good to know that this is the same time period that a man by the name of Charles Loring Brace came up with the brilliant idea to send orphans from the North on trains to the West, where they could live in more rural areas with families that could benefit from having more workers in the fields. They coined this practice the orphan trains, and the goal was to keep kids from growing up in poverty. Although everyone eventually agreed that it was a bad idea, by the early 1900s, over 120,000 children were placed with strangers without any follow-up or oversight through these orphan trains. Now, this did lead to a lot of laws and reforms within Child Protective Services, and by all accounts, Charles Loring Brace's heart was in the right place. But doesn't this remind you of the phrase, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions"? Now back to little Mary Ellen. Since the document shown in court was an agreement of indenture, I really don't think we can call it foster care or adoption. It is more like corruption made easy by a lack of oversight. And I think the lack of oversight in the case of little Mary Ellen is one of the largest problems. All that was expected of Thomas and Mary upon taking over the care for Mary Ellen was a report once a year to the Commissioner of Charities and Correction, a task that the couple failed to do without any follow-up by the agency. So, in case you were wondering, and you figured it out, it's true, little Mary Ellen actually gets a second dad named Thomas. And what's even stranger is her second dad named Thomas also dies shortly after Mary Ellen moves in with the McCormicks under this indenture agreement. Just wait till I get back to why this is so weird. But I can tell you it's not because the second Thomas dies shortly after taking custody of little Mary Ellen, just like the first Thomas. And really, that's pretty weird all in and of itself. But like I said, it gets weirder. Mary McCormick, little Mary Ellen's the adult that's taking care of her, she wastes no time being single. And she marries Francis Connolly and becomes Mary Connolly. Again, if you didn't catch that, Mary Ellen's third sit-in father has the same name as her first biological mother. Not just first biological mother, only biological mother. What? So you can go to cpspodcast.com, and if you click on little Mary Ellen's story, by the photos and the information on the story, you will find a histogram that I put together that includes, it's like a histogram genogram. It includes all of the names and how they are related, because it is very complicated on that front. And from here on out, really, life is total shit for little Mary Ellen. For a reported 6 years, little Mary Ellen is regularly beaten. She is brutally burned. She is kept in a room with only a small place to sleep. And she is kept from the outside world entirely. She's only allowed to go outside when it is dark outside. She is actually gashed in the head with a pair of scissors. She is forced to wear a chain around her neck from time to time, and she is whipped regularly by what is described as a whip that is used on horses. We can all definitely agree that little Mary Ellen is treated worse than animals, and so it shouldn't really surprise us, but it will, that the person who is contacted to try to get help to end the torture that little Mary Ellen was enduring at the hands of Mary Connolly is the founder of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in New York. And this is a Mr. Henry Berg. And you heard that properly. The ASPCA, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which still exists today, is who was contacted to try to figure out how to stop the abuse that little Mary Ellen was facing. I'm actually jumping ahead of myself because it's a Mrs. Wheeler who enters the life of little Mary Ellen without really intending to, and is the one who should really get all the credit for not only speaking up, but also being a tenacious advocate for Mary Ellen. On the day Mrs. Wheeler meets Mary Ellen, it is not her intent to become a child advocate. Her original intent was just to show some compassion to a sick, bedridden woman named Mrs. Smith, who happened to live in the same tenement housing as Mary Ellen at that time. Little Mary Ellen and Mrs. Wheeler only met briefly, and that's all it takes to become shockingly clear to Mrs. Wheeler that taking action on behalf of Mary Ellen was her only choice. But remember, there was no formal process in place at the time. She wasn't really sure what to do. She went from agency to agency, tirelessly working to find a way to remove little Mary Ellen from her abusive situation. As a last resort, she thought of Mr. Berg from the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. She thought maybe he'd know what to do, as he did a great job advocating for animals that were abused by people. Mr. Berg was described as a charismatic, empathetic man, but he also didn't know what to do, at least at first. Eventually, he realizes he has a responsibility to do something. He works with Elbridge T. Gerry, an attorney that worked alongside Mr. Berg at the ASPCA. Together, they decide to petition the courts for custody of little Mary Ellen to be taken away from Mary and Francis Connolly. The only way to do this at the time was to ask the court to take Mary Ellen away based on a common legal remedy that was used to help those detained unlawfully, known as habeas corpus. Now, if you're like me, you may not know what habeas corpus is exactly, but it's basically what makes sure the government can't detain you without proving that you are worthy of being detained. In the case of little Mary Ellen, it allowed Judge Lawrence to bring Mary Ellen to court and to describe what she had endured to him. The judge knew after hearing Mary Ellen's testimony that the Connollys couldn't possibly continue with custody, and that he's going to have to figure out who will now get custody. He subpoenas Mary Connolly with the thinking that he will be able to find out who the biological parents of little Mary Ellen are and the possibility of restoring custody to them. When Mrs. Connolly gets on the stand, she is defensive. She implies that the attorney for Mary Ellen, Mr. Gerry, doesn't know what it takes to be a parent. She goes on record stating she has no idea who the biological parents are. But remember how I said we would go back to the second Thomas? This is where we're going back there. Mrs. Connolly states on the stand in her testimony that she believed her first husband, Thomas McCormick, was the biological parent to little Mary Ellen. This is where I remind you to go to cpspodcast.com and check out the genogram. But I'm going to remind you, because it is very confusing, that Mrs. Mary Connolly was previously Mrs. McCormick. And before she married Francis Connolly, she was married to Thomas McCormick. And it is Thomas McCormick, again, that she is saying is the biological father of little Mary Ellen. So now that we have that sorted, hopefully you can also remember that Thomas McCormick, also known as Second Thomas, was a butcher. And he was certainly not described as anything close to Mary Ellen's biological father, who died fighting in the Civil War on the side of the Union and was an oyster shucker at the St. Nicholas Hotel. This is weird information, because if it turned out the original Thomas and Second Thomas are actually the same person and the biological father to little Mary Ellen, but Mary Connolly is not the biological mother and she's the abuser, it would make more sense that Mary Connolly wouldn't like little Mary Ellen. I don't think it in any way excuses the abuse that little Mary Ellen faced for 6 years, but it does provide motive for that abuse. On the other hand, if it is true, then other accounts in Mary Ellen's story can't be true. The story of little Mary Ellen is taught in many universities when covering the topic of historical child abuse, and it has been retold many times, often for the shock value of the ASPCA being involved in the case. I chose it as a starting point for the CPS podcast overall because I think it really does work to demonstrate how critical Child Protective Services policy is to the outcomes for the children that do face abuse. And I also think there's an important lesson here as well, and it is summed up by a Jewish proverb that says, "What's truer than the truth? The story." I hope you'll think on that and participate in the discussion, which will be aired as the second part to the story of little Mary Ellen. But back to little Mary Ellen's story, we are met with Judge Lawrence, who is still trying to figure out who can take custody of little Mary Ellen. And he's also hearing account after account of the horrible abuses little Mary Ellen faced for 6 years. At the same time, due to Mr. Berg's big-time connections with the press from his work at the ASPCA, the New York Times is periodically updating the public with the details of the testimony and the plight of little Mary Ellen. This leads to cousins living in New York City coming forward, supposed relatives writing letters from England, and women are described as lining the streets of the courts to offer to adopt little Mary Ellen. Now, I don't know where all these people were when Mr. Charles Loring Brace came up with that brilliant idea to put over 120,000 children on trains to the West to work in the fields, but okay. It takes Judge Lawrence until December of 1874 to decide where little Mary Ellen will end up, and it's not with any identified living relative or one of the women that lined up outside of the court looking to adopt. It's with a New York City agency titled Sheltering Arms. So Sheltering Arms is still around today, and it's still in New York City. In fact, the current State Child Protective Services Agency in New York and in New York City is the Administration for Children's Services, currently known as ACS, and they basically have contracts with outside organizations to oversee child placements, services, etc. Sheltering Arms is one of those organizations that has a contract with the state to this day and definitely listen to part two of Mary Ellen's story because I address this further. Now, remember Mrs. Wheeler? The tenacious woman that spoke up when all the other neighbors who listened regularly to the abuse decided not to? She didn't let little Mary Ellen stay very long at Sheltering Arms, and she asked the judge to let a family member of hers raise little Mary Ellen. Perhaps the best part of this story is that little Mary Ellen, after enduring those 6 years of torture, became a wife and mother in adulthood and actually named her daughter Etta, after Etta Wheeler, the tenacious advocate who fiercely fought for little Mary Ellen to grow up and have the life that she had. Now, you might be wondering if anything happens to Francis and Mary Connolly, as they are the two adults responsible for the horrific abuses little Mary Ellen endured. And the answer to that question is sadly, definitely not enough. Francis Connolly gets off entirely, and it doesn't look like he was even brought into court based on the articles written by the New York Times. Mary Connolly, on the other hand, was charged with quite a bit, including assault and battery, felonious assault, assault with intent to do bodily harm, and assault with the intent to kill. However, she is only found guilty of felonious assault and serves just 1 year in a prison camp. In thinking about the stories that we're going to be covering going forward, little Mary Ellen actually does have a happily ever ending. And oftentimes, many of the stories that we're going to cover will not. We do hope that you will recommend some stories that you would like to see us cover. And we hope you listened to this podcast and had all these ideas and questions come to the surface as you were listening. Share them with us. Go to cpspodcast.com. Listen to Little Mary Ellen Part 2, where we will cover these questions and thoughts and bring questions of our own and thoughts of our own back to you. I also urge you to check out things like the images of the St. Nicholas Hotel, images of Little Mary Ellen, Etta Wheeler, and other real characters and places that are depicted in this story. I know putting down Little Mary Ellen's histogram was helpful to me. And you can view all of this at our website at cpspodcast.com.